This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, writing on climate and the SEC. These are two stories I never thought would work so well together, but they do because they're in the Biden administration. There are new imprecations and questions to be answered for the many companies that obey, follow very closely the SEC rules. Richard, a very good evening to you. You will report right away that climate change is a major, major story for the Biden administration and many other sovereignties. However, the Biden administration is now going about making climate change part of the conversation of government, and that extends to the SEC. But before we go there, you list the fact that right away, Mr. Biden moved to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline and pause oil and gas leasing on public lands. Those are two obvious decisions that impact the politics of this, but you make the salient point that there's no way to know whether this has anything to do with climate change. Is that correct?
It's basically correct, and there are a bunch of explanations for it. The simplest one is you cancel a pipeline and you look at the quote unquote direct consequences is that there are less fossil fuel that will go through the pipeline. There are some trivial emissions that may come from the pipeline as proper. And then you will reduce the amount of pipeline stuff that gets to a particular refinery, which you could regulate independently. But what happens is just because you shut down the pipeline doesn't mean that you've shut down the production of fossil fuels. And so it may be that it will get to the same plant by a dangerous means. So that there's, you put it by truck or by rail. These are not isolated environments. And if you had a catastrophe there, it's far more dangerous than a leak from a pipeline. And so things may get worse. You may divert this stuff to China or to some other place, have to ship it longer by more perilous reasons. So you now ship it to a country which is actually going to have dirtier use of it than the United States. And so what they do is they pick one consequence, isolate it as if it's the whole thing, and they never ask themselves in equilibrium what are going to be all the adjustments that are going to be made by every player in the system at every particular time within the system. And so what happens is these are a bunch of people who purport to be scientists, and what they never do is to basically take into account the two major conceptions that you have to do when you're dealing with sciences of this sort. One is this a general equilibrium and is it stable? And two, are the risks that you eliminate greater than the ones that you start to create? They don't do this. And so what happens, this is not science. This is a kind of naive sort of religion. And if you start looking at it, it's ironic. So take the presidential order on the Keystone pipeline. What they do is they put in a paragraph saying why it is that they have to close this thing down. If anybody tried to open a pipeline and gave a single paragraph explanation as to why they are doing it, they would be subject to vicious attack. How could you be so superficial in the way in which you do this? But if you're a government agency and you write one paragraph worth of pap, it turns out that you're a genius. If you're a company that submits, as they did with the Keystone XL pipeline and the DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline and so forth, hundreds of pages of detailed documentation, you're a sap. So what happens is what you do is you have the government playing by two rules. Its own pronouncements need not be justified in any serious way. Private behavior in the opposite direction is subject to excruciating demand. You will not get a sound climate policy if it's run by such partisans.
All right. That is one way to achieve the goal of changing the direction of what we're told is the climate. However, that would be called direct regulation. No more Keystone XL pipeline. Mm-hmm. Or no more oil and gas leasing on federal lands. But there is another route, and Richard spends a deal of time explaining. It's called disclosure. It didn't come to me right away what that meant, but Richard, let's apply it to the SEC. How does disclosure work for the SEC in order to direct private companies?
Well, the first thing you have to do is to understand that disclosure regimes are perfectly sensible in a large number of circumstances. It just depends on what you're asking to be disclosed and how the disclosure is going to be take place. So let me give you an illustration of a very simple disclosure, which everybody seems to like. It's called the Schumer box after Charles Schumer. Now, when you're dealing with consumer loans, it turns out that there's a rather simple formula that you could put together in order to tell you what the effects of the various terms in a loan agreement are worth to a particular consumer. You put the stuff into a box, and all of a sudden, instead of having to read lots of different and disparate terms, you get yourself back to a number which gives you 90% of the information you need at 2% of the cost of its acquisition. We really like that stuff. Other cases of disclosure are a little bit harder. So with respect to the SEC, the original idea was that the competitive markets cannot work if it turns out that there's an imbalance of information that takes place, most notably between insiders on the one hand and the rest of the world on the other. And so what happens is they develop a regime which has two parts to it. One is what you have to do is when you make a new issue of stock, you have to register a disclosure statement for the SEC, which on a form tells you all of the relevant risks that are associated with the operation of a particular business. And in principle, this is a fine thing. But the question is just how granulated do you have to do with this? The word that they use to describe what you need to disclose is the word material. The definition of material is as good as you can get. It's that which is likely to move a reasonable investor to change either the amount of purchase, the timing of the purchase, or the fact of the purchase of any given share of stock. Same thing with respect to selling. But it's like most things in the world. We use words like careful and careless, and we treat them as dichotomous. And then when you push it, what you realize is it's a continuum. We use the words when medicine like safe and unsafe, but you have to figure out how safe is safe enough. Again, it's a continuum. And so what has happened with this area is the definitions of materiality in some cases have been very lax, at which point the government can require a lot of you or allow private individuals to sue for things that are extremely weak. And that's probably a mistake. There was just this past term on the Supreme Court, one of the recent cases involving Goldman Sachs, where Judge Barrett did a pretty good job trying to water down some of these materiality cases. She let it go back to a lower court with a favorable ruling. I would have regarded the stuff as so trivial that I would have given a directed verdict for the defendant that has ousted the case. So that's it. And on the other hand, you get some people in some cases who take materiality to such an extreme that everything is material. And so the system starts to collapse. And you therefore have to understand to keep this there. The hard cases you really want to do, and you could tell them. So if somebody wants to put out a public issue of stock and they don't tell you that the money is going to be used to pay off previous debts and you think it's going to be used for an investment, it would change everything in the way in which you did it. And that was exactly the situation that happened in an English case in 1889 called Derry and Peake, in which the House of Lords said, yeah, this is the kind of thing that's really material. Now we have to ask whether it's fraudulent. Within a year, everybody realized that with respect to disclosure statements and initial issues, fraud is too much of a standard, and the English by statute softened it a little bit, and the SEC has essentially done the same thing. It's a kind of a negligence standard. Then you have insider trading, same thing.
Now we come to the SEC and climate change. Again, this did not come to me that these two things can go together, but the SEC has put out a document asking for comments within 90 days applying to climate change. Richard highlights two of the questions that begin, questions for consideration. This is the SEC, and it's the acting chair, Allison Herren-Lee, has put this statement out, waiting for responses. How can the commission best regulate, monitor, review, and guide climate change disclosures in order to provide more consistent, comparable, and reliable information for investors? Also, what information related to climate risk can be quantified and measured? These are two logical questions, Richard, but I believe that this is a new frontier. This has never been done before. So is the SEC in a position to judge these remarks or judge this information when it arrives?
Well, it's not only the SEC. It's also anybody who's a private party who claims that the disclosures are incomplete and inaccurate, and then you get some other litigation. No, and what's happened is you have to understand this in terms of time frames. When you are doing serious kind of planning, you understand that your ability to estimate is reliable, maybe to 5 years, maybe to 10 years at the very outside. The climate change risks that you're trying to talk about here are extremely long run. And so you're thinking, will there be a flooding of New York Harbor in the year 2050, 30 years from now? And first of all, the data that you have gets more and more reliable as you start to go out. And in addition, what you cannot project by these data is what are going to be the technological developments or the institutional responses that will take place in the intermediate 29 years. You just don't really know how that stuff is going to be. And so nobody but nobody wants to treat this stuff as having the slightest bit of value. What you really want to know is to figure out what's driving price changes today. And anything that's happening 30 years subject subject to those considerations, would influence the price of a share by maybe a penny on $100. This is not material. And they're treating it as though it were. And what they're doing is they're feeding information to all sorts of shareholder activists, including those at Exxon and other companies, so that they can say, aha, you made a mistake on this, and therefore we can milk you in damages. And if people know they're going to be really shot for damages, they're going to start to change their mix of fossil versus non-fossil fuels. And that's the kind of thing that what the FCC wants to do. Now, what is it, something that's really relevant? Take COVID, for example. This has huge impacts on the oil and gas industry because in 2020, the amount of vehicular traffic or the amount of airline traffic plummeted. Well, this is going to change the value of short-term and long-term reserves. And so, generally speaking, you would ask for companies to reevaluate their position on those things to take into account these changes. And they all did, because now you're talking about changes which are not in pennies on hundreds of dollars. These are changes which could be 20, 30, 50% of the particular value of some of these reserves. Well, you have to have a sense of proportion, and the SEC simply does not have that in those things. And then when you want to try to figure out what is relevant with respect to climate change and so forth, it's a loaded question. The way they're asking this is, tell us why it is that this risk is really bigger than we had ever thought. And you would really want to know, suppose you answered the following way. If you look at the history of American use of energy and so forth, since about 2010, it's been a triumph. What has happened is the amount of coal which is used in 2020 is about half of what it was in 2010. The projections in 2010 were for no change. So the market essentially has adopted towards non-carbon type solutions much more rapidly than these predictions have done. So what we think we ought to do is absolutely nothing, because the set of processes already in place in a billion different areas are going to change it. So what are those processes? There's a very important ratio, which is what's the amount of waste that you get when you burn a fossil fuel element. And if you can improve the efficiency of a piston engine from 20 to 30%, right, and the rest of it going off in heat, that's a 50% increase. That's just huge. Well, we've been making improvements like that with virtually every single technology that we have in the engines, in terms of the way in which we get the stuff out. So if you look at the total cost of fracking in 2010 and 2021, they're probably down by 80 or 90%. So the answer is, we don't want to do anything.
All right. Yes, we don't want to do anything. But there's more to this. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you about the police power. Because there is implicit in this SEG document that if you don't provide the answers we intend you to provide, then therefore we'll enforce it. When we come back, what does comply or explain mean in the SEC's questions to companies about climate change during the Biden administration? Richard Epstein, Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.